that I want to leave with you, if I don't leave anything else, is my very deep conviction that a faithful response to what God has done and continues to do for us in and through Jesus Christ frees me, and it might free you, for a quite different way of life. A quite different way of life from that dominating our country and most of the people in our churches. As I experience American life, it is very, very ambiguous. It's much more for me an expression of unfaith than it is of faith. Now, I hope in what I have to say, I'm not trying to lay my trip on you or even convince you that I see things clearly. I only wish to offer my interpretation of things as one way of looking at things. And it may be a gift to you, and it may not. I choose energy as the subject matter in order that in looking at the meaning of faith, we might deal with something concrete. I think the way to avoid hearing the gospel and preaching the gospel is to stay in the realm of generality. And so I could take almost any other issue or any other subject matter of our common life, and I'd come to virtually the same conclusions. So it just happens to be energy that I chose 4 or 5 years ago to be responsible, concrete, and not just stay in my teaching and living up in the realm of generality. Now we're going to have some time together, and I'm going to lay out some things, hopefully not take all the time, and then we'll stop at 11:45, and if I don't remind you, I don't stop, you remind me, and I'll stay here afterwards. First, I just wanted to briefly talk about the theological orientation from which I look at things. In looking at the meaning of faith, I feel you have to look at the historical embodiments of the faith and at the very concrete historical experience. That somehow you can't avoid either one. And many of our social scientists avoid the theological, many of our theologians. At least I have to do it that way. And this is very cryptic, of course. So that the first major affirmation that I want to make in thinking about energy is that God created the world of nature and of human nature. And all things, human and non-human, have a place in God's economy, in God's world. Nothing is created simply for our use in our own way. Everything was created by God with some intention for it in and of itself. Everything then has meaning in the context of the whole of nature and of humankind. Everything, therefore, has what I call an intrinsic meaning. So a stone has an intrinsic meaning as well as a use meaning or an instrumental meaning for us. The whole of nature has an instrumental meaning as well as an intrinsic meaning. Now, this is very mysterious, and it's somewhat sticky, because it is a fact that you can't live except off of other life. There's no way to live. Albert Schweitzer used to preach that you should not live off of animal life. We have many vegetarians for various reasons, but you have to live on vegetable life, or you'd have to live on inorganic life. There's no way simply to live without using other life, integrating it, taking it in. Second, the whole world is interrelated. I've really become convinced that 1 Corinthians 12, where it talks about our belonging to each other and suffering and rejoicing with each other, is a fact of the created world. We are parts of each other. So that if somebody dies early because of the smog, I die too. A part of me dies. It's very hard for us to understand this kind of a reality in our kind of isolated, atomistic looking at parts. But I am convinced that the Christian faith affirms, and I affirm its truth, that if anything happens to you, it happens to me. At a very deep spiritual level, and sometimes in not such a deep spiritual level. Third, meaning for me is both historical and trans-historical. In other words, the other night we were talking about pessimism and optimism. I'm very realistic about calculating how to get things done in this world, and on the other hand, I think there's some things you do and you don't calculate at all. You do them because you feel called by your faith to respond in a certain way. And what happens in history, that what happens in what I call a horizontal level, doesn't matter. It just seems right to do certain things. And the other part of me calculates down to the last level of power as to how something will happen and how one can get it done. Now, for me, it's clear there are no merely technical ways to deal with energy. We can't turn over the issues to technicians. There are very complex technical issues, but I, as a kind of layman, have to try to deal with these issues and have to try to make up my own mind on the basis of my faith. Let me summarize then what I did say on Monday, what I will say throughout this whole approach to energy. It's my contention that energy issue is a moral, a political, and a religious issue. It seems clear to me that we need to use different kinds of energy sources. We need to use energy more efficiently, and we need to make our decisions about energy use in a different way. We need a whole public program that is only possible if we use governmental agencies. And on Saturday, I will talk about my public program, how I intend to deal with the energy issues as a political, as a governmental program, how I think we ought to deal with them. Energy, then, is a moral issue in this sense. We have a responsibility to use different kinds of energy, less energy, and to make our decisions differently. It also has been argued that we need to consider decentralizing the productive process in energy, or in many other things too, in order to make the energy process more accessible to our control. It's my conviction, I share with a number of people, that the present organization of the energy industry contributes to the undermining of the democratic politics. That's a long story, and we might discuss it later. I will not really lay it out today. But the energy issue is a political issue. It makes a lot of difference in our politics what we do in the way we deal with energy. Underlying the moral and political issues is what I call the religious issue. We have developed a way of being, a way of life that requires great amounts of energy to sustain it. Our differentiated, fragmented life requires much transportation in order to integrate it. Our search for meaning in the face of meaningless work and meaningless living generally causes us to expend energy on things, services, and travel in search of respite from boredom, from isolation, and from meaninglessness. Well, now those of you who know what I mean by all that can leave, because that's all I got to say. I now would like to develop this thesis that we use too much energy, that our society has developed in such a way that we use too much. If we believe that the resources of life, as well as our own lives, were provided in continuous creation as gifts of God, we would not only act as good stewards of the resources for the sake of all life, present and future, But we would also attend to the created limits or the givens of life and listen to what that reality points to regarding the way we are living. I mean, we would accept the fact that pollution occurs as God's way of saying something to us about the way we were living. And it would be a kind of gift which would open up the fact that somehow if that's what we do to the biological rhythms, then it raises real questions about the way we are living. In other words, we would accept the limits not simply as something to be overcome or adjusted to reluctantly, talking about deprivation the other night, I don't like that word, but also as symbols of the meaning of our being and as guideposts for human fulfillment. In other words, instead of becoming something which becomes a task, although it is a task, it becomes a gift. The limits that we encounter say to us things which then cause us to respond in such a way that our lives are enriched and opened up and new possibilities occur. To argue that we use too much energy is to argue that the way of being or the lifestyle that dominates our society is questionable. Now, I think we've organized our lives in a way that requires a whole complex of attitudes, behaviors, and institutions which are problematic. Among these is our use of energy, especially non-human forms of energy. For example, we have organized our lives so that the human body is not required by the ordinary activities of the day to be called upon except in very limited ways. As a result, we now have all kinds of health clubs, health programs, jogging jags, yoga sessions, and all kinds of things, all of which in a way is therapeutic. It's a kind of response to the fact that our ordinary way of life doesn't really keep us healthy. It comes as a response to the destructive or debilitating effects of the normal patterns of most people's living. I was thinking this morning in rereading this that if everybody lived in a way that they had to walk up to where I live 3 or 4 times a day, you wouldn't need to take any walks or anything else. And some people have suggested that we need to reorganize our cities of about 200,000, and this is a very serious proposition by a group from the University of Wisconsin, so that you could walk and bike to work, to shop, to church, to everything. And you wouldn't just have to get in a car, and other ways of life would result in our physical health. I was really amused the other day when I saw a fellow who could have played tackle or guard on any pro football team riding a lawnmower, a little tiny lawnmower, and he just overarched the whole seat, and it was a small, about very small, 20 by 30 yard he was mowing on this thing, sitting on this seat, and I couldn't but think of what power that person had, and how he probably had to do some special things for exercising. Now, the situation is the same with regard to the energy embodied in goods and services. While it is clear that per dollar expended, electricity and gasoline and oil are by far the most energy intensive, all goods and services require energy inputs. And it's not so much. For example, for kitchen and household appliances involve 58,000 BTUs per dollar spent, electricity 502,000, gasoline and oil 430, women's and children's clothing 33,000, men's and boys 31,000, I don't know why there's a difference, restaurants 32,000 per dollar spent, private hospitals, 26,000, tobacco products, 19,000 and on. Telephone and telegraph, 19,000 per dollar spent. Everything we do requires energy. Thus, a society that does not provide satisfactions in work and other more or less routine activities of living encourages the use of goods and services in order to secure psychic satisfactions otherwise denied. That is to say, the use value of the goods and services does not explain the amounts of goods and services purchased, and the indirect energy expended. I believe that one has to understand much of what goes on in our society as an effort to compensate for the destructive or non-fulfilling aspects of our present way of life. We spend billions of dollars therapeutically in patchwork when these billions could be spent in more basic work if we had the conception and the will to reorder family, education, and work reality. Now I want to talk about the character of the life which leads, in my judgment, to this kind of life that we have. And in my judgment, one could simply take the principles that our highfalutin scholars refer to as the principles of modernity, those principles which underlie the whole direction of the West, and especially the West in the last 400 or 500 years, and one could characterize what I'm calling the destructive aspects. Now, it's important to realize that these aspects are not destructive in and of themselves. They're only destructive if they become the total focus. Because what I'm going to talk about are some other principles or kind of directions for life, which, if pursued as single-heartedly as the ones we are pursuing, would also lead in destructiveness. But in the light of what the history has been, I think we need to move in some different directions. Modernity is a way of life in which functions and meanings are fragmented and autonomous. We divide up or differentiate or fragment. Great word in Talcott Parsons is differentiation. We differentiate or fragment life as much as possible. We even do that at Holden. We just have a string of people coming through here, and you get a little bit of each other, and then you're gone, and you struggle like all get out to maintain some relationship to that little bit of somebody that you had up here. And it is almost impossible. I'm not saying that that isn't of some value, but it just characterizes all of our life. And we avoid as much as possible relating one aspect to another except in a kind of external, instrumental way. Functions are fragmented or differentiated or separated into smaller and smaller specialized parts or functions. While the parts are sometimes coordinated or externally related, generally speaking, the whole has become less and less central. One performs a special function on an assembly line. One's skills and capacities are related to less and less that seems to have meaning in itself, or that gives the sense of doing anything useful or having developed a capacity with some continuing usefulness. One finds health care provided by an increasing number of specialists. Knowledge is more and more fragmented, and universities have many departments within which there is further specialization. One is expected to know more and more about particular aspects of smaller dimensions of reality. The functional parts are not expected to explain themselves to each other or to be able to relate themselves to each other except externally, that is, administratively. And one wonders whether or not administrators understand the relation of the parts to some significant whole. The parts are autonomous laws unto themselves. In theory, at least, political, economic, educational, scientific, technological, and religious dimensions of life are to be allowed to function independently, autonomously of each other. Each does its own thing with a minimum of interference from the others. And as it is with function, so it is with meaning, if we can separate such matters. Education is expected to be neutral. That means to be technical, or at best to be historically humanistic. Educators are not expected to ask the meaning questions in a way that involves them and their students in facing personally and individually the meaning of what they are studying. Economic institutions are not expected to ask about the value of their enterprises. It really is irresponsible. Many, many people claim, Paul Hayne among them, one of my dearest friends who comes here, Economic enterprises are really irresponsible if they ask the ethical questions about what they're doing. If they ask about the meaning of what they are doing, persons are trained and socialized in preparation for the performance of functions within particular segments of the system. Without persistent demands in regard to the meaning of such functions for the society as a whole, or without question as their relation to the meaning of life in the society in some ultimate sense. And so we have a Haldeman and Ehrlichman who say they did what the system required of them. And all throughout our various institutions, you find the same attitude. You become a cog in a machine, and you do what the system requires without asking the meaning of that. And if you ask the meaning of it, you are really in trouble frequently and unable to function. Fragmentation and autonomy are associated with constant change and a sense of freedom from limits. Participations in communities which give content to one's individual life while at the same time limiting one's freedom are de-emphasized. All I'm saying here is that we have constant change, constant focus upon doing our own thing, the whole therapeutic way of life that's so much in our psychology, doing our own thing in a way frees us from some of the constraints that may be debilitating, but it doesn't free us for the kinds of participations without which there is no life. You can't do your own thing except in relation to some responsibility for something which seems significant, and that means participating in something which seems significant. One cannot have too many attachments, actually, to communities if one is expected to change one's abode physically and spiritually from time to time in response to the call of one's specialized function. We're trying to develop a community in our church, and within 2 months, two of the very crucial families in the community move because their economic roles call them to move to California in one case and to Vermont in the other case. And so what we are trying to develop as a kind of community where people would care for each other and begin to spend some time thinking about each other became fragmented. I don't know how you deal with the issues, because they're very real issues when one has a specialized function which he can only perform, or she only can perform, in a very few places. The forms which limit an order life give way to change. The destinies which provide limits, natural, psychological, and spiritual, are subordinated to the freedoms to do what can be done. Thus, what some hail as the continuing basis of everything modern and good of the past several hundred years, the fragmentation or differentiation and autonomy of function and meaning must be challenged, I think. Whereas we have fostered fragmentation or individualization, our own careers, the development of our own talents, we will foster participation in the future, that is, the next 200 years. Whereas we have focused on parts, the individual, the development of the individual, we'll focus on wholes. We really depended on the interaction of parts in order to bring out the whole in its meaning and in its good. Whereas we have wanted change or whatever is new, we will focus on persisting forms. Whereas we have worshipped freedom as kind of self-initiation, we will recognize the crucial role of the givens that set limits for our freedom. Whereas we have concentrated on meaning in a kind of horizontal, historical reality, we will move toward meaning that transcends history, meanings that do not focus on what we can do and make. Whereas we have focused on making and shaping and controlling, we will focus on receiving and listening and perceiving and taking in reality as over against trying to shape it and make it and create it in the image that we want it to be. And I make my disclaimer again that this is a dialectic, that health and meanings and life requires both the individualization and the participation, both the part and the whole, both change and persisting form, both freedom and attention to the givens. But given our history, it will appear in the next 200 years, and it already has appeared in many cultures, in many parts of the world, it will appear that we're moving completely in the other direction. And there is a sense in which we have to move very vigorously in the other direction. In this interpretation, history is viewed as a movement which involves shifts of emphasis. In our particular period, the undue focus on the individual, on change, on freedom, and on the historical, must be offset by a rigorous, radical movement toward participation, forms, givens, and realities below the surface of life. Now, I think this situation characterizes all of the West, it characterizes many European countries, Canada, Japan, Australia, Soviet Union to a great extent. Socialism, in a way, is bought into this whole thing, although in principle it at least recognizes the need for consideration of the whole, but it's bought into the whole differentiated, fragmented, technical functioning, it seems to me. So what I'm saying is that while we can talk about a lot of programs, and I will on Saturday, that will change our use of energy, change it toward renewable resources and toward a great program for efficient use of energy and for more participation politically in the processes by many of us, unless this fundamental structure of our life, the way of being, shifts, be no way out of the change. What am I to do with one of my daughters, my youngest daughter in the Northwest Territory at Fort Simpson, teaching Indians, and one son just bought a square mile in Costa Rica, another daughter in Tucson, and one son in Washington, D.C. What am I to do in terms of the way I live if I'm going to relate to my family except to expend a lot of energy and a lot of money, a lot of services? Cost us $1,500 to go up to Coppermine, where she was teaching Eskimos, 200 miles north of the Arctic Circle. And that was kind of minimum. How in this world, where everything is fragmented, that's just my experience. Other families kind of stay together. So actually, I'm required, in order to meet the needs of this fragmented society, I think, to form a community in our church which replaces, in many ways, the blood family, if I want to have the kind of relations which extended blood families have provided in the past, which they don't now, and without which I think we're really in trouble as individuals trying to raise children and as persons trying to live. Well, that's all I wanted to say, and what kind of, many of you may have other ideas about how energy is a religious issue, or what the religious issue is underlying the energy issue.
Do I hear you that there is one cosmos?
There's one creation.
Okay. Then why do you say nature and human nature?
Well, I only do that to focus on the fact that we tend to think of human nature as what is created. And we tend to think of nature as somehow there for our use and not having its created. I only do that really to focus on the fact that both are one. It's just a matter of calling attention to it.
Even on a psychological level, I think that there are similarities between humans and non-humans in the living world, and that our needs and our wants and our desires are pretty much the same.
There are similarities and differences, of course, at all levels of reality. I'm simply trying to say that we can't treat a stone somehow as simply a thing and not as somehow having a life and a meaning of its own. That's a little difficult. In other words, this is a sacramental view of reality where all reality participates in the holy. So you have to really respond to all reality as holy, and therefore with a kind of care and thoughtfulness and concern that we can avoid. In ripping out, I think of the dunes where I spent 13 summers, of just ripping out nature's rhythms and what nature has created. I'm not saying you don't have to rip some of it out, but you can't rip it out without it being an ambiguous ripping out, without your pain. Now, you can't just do it, and therefore it gives you quite different view of how you approach nature, I think. Do you have something else in mind?
Why is it that if a community is started, like you say, and it's going fine, it's working, then two pivotal families move, like you said, one in California, one to Maine, the whole community fails?
Oh, I didn't say that. It hasn't failed.
Oh, it hasn't failed?
Oh, no.
Oh.
All I'm saying is that we were just beginning to form our community, and we were talking, just like we're talking here frequently, about the fragmentation and about the need for each other and the care and discussing our lives and our great decisions together. And then these two families moved. One discussed it with us. We didn't have much response. We had some chance to respond to the needs of this person for a more meaningful role than he had. His wife had a tenured job, but she went with him and gave up her tenure. All the issues of our modern life, of course, are kind of involved. But the other couple just didn't even discuss it. And they felt very, very strongly, of course, about the wrench that it was. All I'm saying, in the beginning of our formation of our community, that just happened, actually. I just started in my official work on this community 1st of January, and by March we'd lost two families that had been a part of the discussions and the thinking and the being.
But this has happened before.
Oh, it happens all over. You know, all of
these communities have failed because two pivotal families leave.
Yeah.
I just wonder,
we're in the process now of buying a 20 apartment building to move some of our people in. So it's going, but it just, it's a wrench for you, and you realize that your community is very fragile because the system will move all kinds of people. What do they say in a church? One quarter of the suburban church moves every year. I know maybe that's not a good figure, but I remember one study some years ago in St. Louis churches. That was a fact. One quarter of the members of the church moved every year. What does that do to the fabric of a life? What does it do to the time and energy you spend relating to each other when that stuff is ripped out and you can't build on it? Don't have a continuity.
But if you look at it as a positive thing, there may be some reason that the Lord pulls those families out, because there may be some need wherever they go to take the learning and the experience to California to start a pivotal community there.
There may be, but I have a hard time seeing it.
Yeah, in other words,
feeling it. I have a hard time feeling it. When the people I've invested my life in move, I have a hard time. And just my kids. It's great maybe that they're where they are, but I don't know my grandchildren. I have no way of knowing my grandchildren.
But the problem that is, if we get into small communities and we stay there, it's very comfortable. But we can't wall
very
out the rest of the world.
I'm not sure it's comfortable. It's a different way of being. Mm-hmm.
I think it's more comfortable because we're around people that we relate to and have common interests and everything else. But I think we have to get out in the world, too, and spread out.
Plenty of world in Chicago for the people in my community to be in. And we have a sense of mission to the whole city.
I don't know how comfortable it is, because I see people fleeing. You watch the younger people, they flee to big cities, to get lost, and then they get frustrated in being lost because they've lost the very opportunity for community, because they don't want the intimacy, they think, at that point in their life. They feel it closes in.
Yeah, that's what the sociologists say. The enemy of the city is a great place for people to do the things which the constraints, givens, morals, habits of a local community deny. In that sense, you've got a dialectic, you see, that there are some very constraining things in a community. And my thesis is, of course, that we've got to move back to it because we've lost it. Everything has gone the other way. And if we don't move back, we will simply suffer. There will be more unhappy people, more counseling, more guys in meaningless jobs who don't know how to deal with it, and all kinds of things. It's not simply the community. It's also the way the institutions function. Economic, political, education, all the institutions are involved. And our community, I hope, will get some economic enterprise. We're going to go toward housing. I think the church should go toward housing. It should have economic enterprise. Campus Church in Minneapolis has 80 people working in what are called fish industries. In other words, we have to have another way of being. Now, how do you approach the massive society? Sometimes you just think it's unbreachable. The way of being is so strong, so dominating, there's just no way to establish another way of being. And I don't know whether there is.
Yeah, well, Dr. Yoder was talking away about this. He comes out of the Mennonite tradition, and he said that what his solution, the way he could live it, was that you follow the rule of Christ as best you could, and if society, then the mass, wanted to in some way restrict you or punish you, or whatever else, if that was up to them to do it, you lived the way you could. The way you felt you should, and you followed the rule of Christ to the greatest extent that you could, but that you held on to your convictions, and that's all you can do, that's all you can expect.
It's a very complex thing, of course, because you've got to earn a living, and you've got kids, and we're going to talk about that tonight. The adults decide to go into a different way of being, which uses much less of the materials and doesn't buy all the things and travel all over to be at Disneyland and all these other places, on the theory that you can really have a joyful time like we have here together without all of that. Really a joyful time. If you could get that in the cities, then you wouldn't have to do a lot of the other. You are not free in the culture to just do it for yourself. You've got all the other things. And how people earn a living, I think the great thing over the 7 years we've been here is people want to move into a different lifestyle, but they do not have institutions which permit them to do that. And so you get caught. And it's not an easy thing. I'm only suggesting some issues. And I don't have any formulas, and I don't know whether what I'm involved in is going to amount to a hill of beans, except a few people are excited about it. And I feel I need it personally, and it looks like it would be some fun, and we could have a little bit of Holden in the midst of the city of Chicago. And
well, isn't, in a sense, though, if a community or anything else of that nature were to succeed, you have to keep in mind the natural process, let's say the homeostasis, the cycling, whether it be physical or biological, that there's going to be a constant change. It has to be a dynamic, circular pattern, and there's going to be spinning off. There's going to be adding to it.
Oh, yeah.
In so many cases where there's been a lack of success, it's maybe been the rigidity, the slowing down or the taking out of this momentum of the cycle. And I think many times communities will lose this very thing. And to me, the cycling, the homeostasis, this is God's, let's say, the ultimate energy that God breathed into to nature.
I'm not sure I know all you're saying.
I'm thinking both from the social as well as the environmental
aspects of whether we're talking about a community of just families and so on, or whether we're talking about man in nature. It doesn't make any difference. We have the same basic principle. It has to be dynamically functioning, not become static.
But the question is, how much change? You see, from my point of view, reality is both the dynamic and the static, and the question is, how much change do you get? And I think too much change and you just destroy life. And neighborhood after neighborhood has had so much change that the whole fabric, all the institutions, you can just go down a block and the kind of fabric of the neighborhood where there were coffee houses and little shops and all that is gone. I mean, I live in a community like that. You go down 71st Street, I live in the South Shore, it's practically all black now. It was a Jewish community. And I wanted to get some art stuff, so I looked in the directory and there was an art shop. I went, it wasn't there anymore. I mean, you know, it just...
But on the other hand, there's not enough change to become static.
I agree. See, that's the beauty of my system. I can handle all your questions in the dialectic. But all I'm saying is that we've had too much change. But if we got rigid, you see, I think the Reformation was a reaction, taking it broadly, against the feudalistic rigidities in the whole system. And it was one of the most creative periods in history. But now the swing has got to go the other way. And it's very difficult, these swings there, because people get all enamored of not only intellectually but being wise, and they really believe in the principles. You just get ardent believers in the principle of self-initiation as the only principle. Freedom is self-initiation. And the fact that one is given boundaries by God that are abrogated only at the cost of your whole meaning is denied. You know, those are way off, and maybe you'll recognize a few. Well, why don't we talk among ourselves and not direct it toward me now for a while? And what's your experience? What do you think? Does it make sense to think of the energy issue as really, in the long run, not solvable unless we have a way of life which simply doesn't need so much energy because we organize our life differently. We have communities which share cars and share resources and share lawnmowers and, you know, all kinds of things that reduce the kind of energy input to the whole system.
By sharing. Yeah. 10 people have a lawnmower and you only have one for 10 people, over a period of time, do you use the same number? Wear out the same number?
That's a good practical question. You may or you may not.
Well,
certainly in the initial stages for the next 10 years or so, if you were in a community and you've got all kinds of problems, because like everything else, you've got to recycle. I mean, if you say you want your cars to go 40 miles per get 40 miles per gallon, well, you got a fleet. It takes you 10, 12 years to recycle your fleet. So in the immediate, it wouldn't make a lot of difference in some of these things. But I always figure by 2000, what's the character of our life? You know, and so the plan, my plan is to figure out what we should be doing generally by 2000 and move in that direction.
We're coming out of a path that we can't just look back 20 years and say, oh, those people were so wasteful. Look at all the energy they wasted. I think in a way, the scientific community is somewhat, not to blame, but at least we're remiss in either recognizing or pointing out adamantly that this was not an indefinite forever supply. And so that I wouldn't look at it quite so sourly, looking ahead, because we've now been informed this supply is not going to last forever.
And we all still drive 70, 80 miles an hour and do all the other things. You know, I mean, the information certainly is not the the only answer. That gets into how we're going to do this Saturday, I guess. How you would respond. I don't look at the past as anything but a gift. I mean, how can you else look at the past as a gift? The question is, how do you look at the future? Certainly, every morning is new, and so you don't worry too much about how things were done. You're forgiven, and if you did, and that energy was cheap. You know, it simply was cheap, and we thought we had a lot of it, so we were kind of irresponsible. But the question is, what do we do today, tomorrow? Now, I'm very optimistic, I guess, and not too worried about the past, except what we learn from it. And if you look at the long sweep of history, I try to look at the long sweep of history and say, well, what does that mean for the next 200 years? Early, you wanted to say something.
It's okay.
Just go ahead. I don't
think the government will allow this to really happen. Big business. They say big business first. Second, the government, I feel, are applying for big business. There's too much money involved for all these things that, you know, are spending energy. But that money is what the world is. It's what America is. It's what, you know, that's what people are after. And if your type of community goes, I mean, if I lived in Chicago, I'd want to live in it. But if it really goes, money is going to hurt. And I think there's going to be people that will allow it to happen.
I hate to hear people talk about big business that way, because we're all supported by big business. One of the things that has to be considered, of course, is what happens if all of a sudden start buying 10% of the lawnmowers that we used to. What happens to all the people that are involved and engaged in manufacturing those, and, you know, designing them, and marketing them, and distributing them, and selling them to the public? We've, for the last, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we've been wrapping little threads of string around us, making statements like, the automobile is here to stay. Two cars in every garage. And we've gotten ourselves into a situation where we have one out of every seven people engaged in the automotive industry in some way. So what happens if we start consuming less? How do we handle that aspect of the problem? We are a big business. All of us are involved in it. All of us, we all have hands in it.
Does that mean for you, don't do anything?
No, it doesn't. I just asked the question, how do we handle that aspect of it? But I hate, on the other hand, to say that big business is at fault, because we've done the purchasing, we've worked for big business, we've made America what it is today by consuming it.
So big business doesn't buy the cars and drive them 70, 80 miles an hour. But it does have a great interest in the perpetuation of the system. And all of us, you know, are in the same way. What do you do if you don't participate in the...
On the other hand, big business is not capable of...
I would say that the most idolatrous system I know anything about is the Divinity School at the University of Chicago. I don't want to just lay this all on big business. That's what I know about, and very idolatrous. It's bought into all these values of fragmentation, autonomy, and the whole system. Meaninglessness, scientific study of religion, you know, everything that I've talked about. I don't think one institution everybody is bought. All the institutions are supporting the way of being that I describe. And so I appreciate that.
I'd like to follow on. Where do you think it's possible to start? On the whole, that difficult problem of dealing with the future of big business.
Well, the one thing that I see, first of all, is that big business, or any business, makes what the public demands. And the first thing that has to be understood is that we want something different than we're getting. People buy, some people say in retail that people don't buy what they want. They buy what they can get. And the first thing that we have to make understood, or that has to be understood by business, is what people want and what direction we want to go in. And we have to make that decision ourselves as a group. And once we've made that decision, then business will say, if they're making one item, they'll say, if we want to survive, we're going to have to make maybe less of something with more quality in order to employ the amount of people that it'll take to sustain the workforce and keep the people in somewhat the same socioeconomic place, where then we can go and manufacture things that are more practical. But people have an abundance of money, and they seem to spend their money on whatever appeals to them at the moment. That's how I make my living. People who actually buy things that are not really necessary but are appealing. Maybe they are necessary. They wouldn't buy them unless they weren't necessary to them, but they're not necessities.
Do you think how the church plays into that? That whole process you're talking about?
Into the process of
making decisions and figuring out what you need in contrast to what you can get?
No, I haven't had a chance to think about it.
I think it's a process of re-educating people. In other words, I think what we've got now is a throw-away society. In other words, if something breaks or something becomes what you think is unuseful, rather than taking it someplace or fixing yourself because you can't trust, or if you have something fixed, you get it back home and it really isn't fixed because we don't have, or wherever it's fixed, it is, people don't care about it anymore. So rather than have the chance of still broke when I get it back, I just throw it away and buy a new one. Like a can opener, for example. You don't fix a can opener. You don't take a can opener down to have it fixed. Throw it away and buy a new one because it's only $9.95 or something like that. And that's our education. It's only $9.95 when it's probably $8.95 to get it fixed. So I throw it away. So I think that re-educate people and also get the technical ability to care. In other words, not the quantity, but the quality. When you get something back of being fixed, it works. So the technician in the aspect of caring about something, that it works after he fixes it. And the people wouldn't throw things away.
Well, the condition you're describing, I think, is a result of cheap energy.
Mm-hmm.
And an energy-intensive society. And as energy becomes more expensive, which is inevitable, your can opener won't cost $8.95. It'll cost $38.95, and you won't throw it away quite so blithely. And we will be repairing things again, and there will be a service industry developed, perhaps, that will replace some of the people who will be unemployed because manufacturing will have to slow down.
But in answer to his question, the problem is that we don't want to force the idea of when a can opener costs $38.95, then we have it fixed. I think that the right now is the time for the church and all institutions to educate us in the fact that we can no longer afford to be a throwaway society. Let's not wait till the can opener becomes $38.95. Let's educate our people now, because television and all other aspects are saying that you cannot do without that new can opener. Your can opener may not have a knife sharpener on it. But you've got to have a can opener to stay up with the Joneses that has a knife sharpener on. So I think that we've got to re-educate what's being educated in the public world. And I think that this is the job of the church to do that educating. You don't need to keep up with the Joneses. You don't need a 78 car. You don't need a new can opener. Fix what you have.
Well, isn't big business kind of cheating the public? Like 30 years ago, you'd get a refrigerator, and some people still have it. 5 years ago, you got a refrigerator, and it's broken already. The quality material they put in it, but it's big business.
But
how about now you go to the grocery store, it takes two paper bags to hold your groceries.
But they want you to believe that that refrigerator is old-fashioned, even though it works.
I mean, you have to put the bags together, because they're not strong enough to hold it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, big business, why can't they make quality instead of just quantity? And they're cheating us, really, because they charge so much more for that new refrigerator that doesn't last worth anything.
I disagree.
That's our fault.
I think they charge.
I sure it's our fault, but what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, that's the thing.
The refrigerator is less expensive, and people tend to want to buy an item that is less expensive. Probably per man hours, the refrigerator you buy today probably be less expensive.
Well, those big businesses know what they're doing. They're not making it to last. Because they want
to
keep buy.
From the education standpoint, we talk about the 995 can opener or the 3895, and we find really that 29 or 59 cent hand can opener will work for more.
That's the kind we get.
So I think that's sort of what we're talking about here.
It is really strange, though. My brother-in-law and his wife gave us an electric can opener. And what was I to do? My wife uses it, and I don't. And I'm the one who opens all the cans and crushes them and everything, so I got to do it double, with the hand. I don't know. It's symbolic, of course, not to use it. Our whole society, even if I wanted not to use the electric or have it, I got it.
Well, we really don't need those brown bags either.
I really want to get us off who is to blame, though. I mean, who is to blame for this?
Well, for instance, the irons. They make the irons so that they'll iron anything. And they make the material that doesn't have to be iron.
Whoever is to blame, we finally make the decisions. We personally make the decisions about what we're going to do, and I'm convinced that we can together in the church move in different directions. I'm a little leery of education. I'm much more interested in being. That is, if we have a joyful alternative lifestyle and way of being evidenced, I think it's much more attractive than to lay trips on people and head trips kind of. Not that I'm an educator, I spend my life, I'm educating here, but I've said that about Holden too, and I'm very happy now. The food is beginning to change, and maybe get herbal tea if I have my way soon, And in other words, they will embody some things about a different lifestyle, as well as have all these head trips we go on here together. It's a combination, I'm sure you agree.
Isn't that it's a combination of educating by doing.
Yeah.
Right?
But I'm much more interested myself in the being aspect is over against the head thing now, and trying to embody a different way of being and see just what, where it goes and have people come in and participate in it. I've said for a long time, what Holden ought to be is a permanent community of a different way of being, and people in the summer would come in and live for 2 or 3 weeks, hopefully. I know you're hard to afford because of your roles and all they require of you, but live for a time and experience it and have enough being here so it isn't just us kind of meeting each other, but there's a reality here. There is a reality here, of course. It's a matter of degree. Well, it is a 11:45. I promised you we'd, those of you, we'll adjourn officially, and some of us will sit around and get some more smoke.